Die Presse.
Ein frühlingshaftes Hallo und herzlich willkommen zu einem neuen Kapitel der Eastside Stories. Wir sind Martina Czarnowska
und Thomas Seifert.
Die Temperaturen ziehen an und die Energiepreise auch, denn die Welt steht nicht still. Seit Ende Februar herrscht Krieg am Persischen Golf. Die Straße von Hormuz ist praktisch gesperrt und die Energiepreise explodieren. Was bedeutet das für Europa?
Ja, was bedeutet das? Die Lage ist dramatisch. Seit Beginn der amerikanisch-israelischen Luftangriffe auf den Iran am 28. Februar hat sich die Situation im Persischen Golf zur schwersten Energiekrise seit den 1970er Jahren entwickelt. Der Iran hat mit Vergeltungsschlägen gegen Schiffe und Infrastruktur in der gesamten Golfregion auf die Angriffe reagiert und die Straße von Hormuz, durch die normalerweise rund 20% des weltweiten Öls transportiert werden, die ist faktisch geschlossen.
Damit ist der Tankerverkehr fast vollständig zum Erliegen gekommen. Der Ölpreis ist auf über $100 pro Barrel gestiegen, zeitweise sogar auf 126
Dollar. Vielleicht steigt er auf 150.
Wir werden sehen. Auf jeden Fall spricht auch die Internationale Energieagentur von der größten Versorgungsstörung in der Geschichte des globalen Ölmarkts.
Ja, und für Europa bedeutet das höhere Energiepreise, steigende Inflation und dadurch wieder eine mögliche Rezession. Und das alles zu einem Zeitpunkt, an dem der Kontinent gerade erst begonnen hat, sich von den Folgen des Angriffskriegs Russlands auf die Ukraine und den damit einhergehenden Gaskrieg sozusagen zu erholen.
Doch gibt es ein Land in Europa, das zwar wie andere im Zentrum dieser Krise steht, sich aber in letzter Zeit, und das nicht unbedingt von allen bemerkt, zu einem Energiehub entwickelt hat.
Welches Land ist das?
Es ist Griechenland. Aha. Ich erwähne das deswegen, weil aus Athen unsere heutige Sprachnachricht kommt. Aber zuvor verraten wir noch, wohin uns unser Hauptgespräch führt, nämlich nach Budapest. Denn am 12. April wird in Ungarn ein neues Parlament gewählt.
Ja genau, und da war ich in Budapest eben und wir haben mit Timiás Szabó gesprochen, einer Abgeordneten im ungarischen Parlament, die für die grüne Partei Pabeszéd, auf Deutsch Dialog, im Parlament sitzt und nun als unabhängige Kandidatin in Budapest antritt. Und an dieser Stelle möchte ich mich gleich bei all jenen, die als ungarischen mächtig sind, entschuldigen. Ich bin mir sicher, ich spreche all diese Begriffe völlig falsch. Also bitte um Verzeihung.
Im Übrigen ist eine Woche nach Ungarn Bulgarien an der Reihe. Dort wird ebenfalls gewählt und zwar ist es schon die 8. Parlamentswahl innerhalb von 5 Jahren. Aber das wollte ich nur erwähnt haben und nun schauen wir ins benachbarte, von dort aus gesehen, ins benachbarte Griechenland. Wie erwähnt, haben wir eine Sprachnachricht aus Athen bekommen von Agis Dikas. Dikas ist einer der führenden Energieexperten des Landes. Er lehrt Umweltpolitik und Ethik an der Nationalen Technischen Universität in Athen sowie Geopolitik und Energiesicherheit an der Griechischen Schule für Nationale Sicherheit. Er war auch unter anderem Vizepräsident des griechischen Betreibers für erneuerbare Energiequellen, ein Sektor, in dem das Land eine beachtliche Karriere hingelegt hat. Hören wir uns nun seine Nachricht an.
Voice Message. What's up, Athen?
Καλημέρα σας, είμαι ο Άγης Δίγκας από την Αθήνα. In today's world, energy security is no longer a regional concern, but a global one. Nowhere is this more evident than the US-Iran conflict. Critical energy infrastructure such as pipelines and refineries forms the backbone of the global economy. Any disruption to this system does not stay local. For the European Union, which remains a net importer of energy, stability in these regions is not optional but essential. Last week, a major strike on Qatar's natural gas infrastructure destroyed approximately 20% of its LNG export capacity. This is not just a regional setback, as Qatar is a strategic partner for Europe, and such damage directly impacts European supply. A day later, another potential crisis was avoided, as an attempt strike to Saudi Arabia's largest refinery was successfully intercepted by Greek anti-missile systems deployed in the area. This defensive action protected infrastructure that is vital not only for the global oil market, but also for the long-term stability of the EU and the region itself. These incidents underline a critical point. Protecting energy infrastructure is not just about safeguarding supply chains. It's about preserving future stability even for those currently in conflict. The European Union was forged through regional conflict, but it was also built on the values of cooperation, security, and a deep understanding of long-term implications. And countries like Greece are carrying that vision forward, taking action to protect what matters not just for today, but for the future and the benefit of EU.
Danke nach Athen. Agis Dikas beschreibt dort eine Situation, die Griechenland ganz unmittelbar betrifft. Das Land besitzt die größte Handelsflotte der Welt. Rund 30% der globalen Tankerflotte gehören griechischen Reedereien. Mit der Sperre der Straße von Hormuz sind diese Schiffe direkt von den Angriffen, den explodierenden Versicherungsprämien und dem Stillstand des Tankerverkehrs betroffen. Agis Dikas gehört übrigens zum Kreis der Autoren der neuen Ausgabe von European Voices, die so eben erschienen ist.
Ja, ein absolut lesenswerter Beitrag. Aber kommen wir jetzt zu unserem Hauptgespräch. Wie gesagt, am 12. April wählt Ungarn ein neues Parlament. Und zum ersten Mal seit 2010 könnte Viktor Orban tatsächlich abgewählt werden. Die Oppositionspartei TISA unter Peter Magyar liegt in den unabhängigen Umfragen deutlich vorne. Und für viele Ungarn wäre das eine Befreiung nach 16 Jahren Fidesz-Herrschaft.
Du klingst sehr optimistisch, als ob es da tatsächlich einen Wandel geben würde.
Ja, das in Budapest haben das eigentlich fast alle gesagt, dass sie daran glauben, dass Orban abgewählt wird. Ja, meine Hoffnung, ich sehe das mal vielleicht auch so, sobald die Lottoziehung vorbei ist, kaufe ich mir ein Los mit einem oder zwei Tipps, weil das ist eine Eintrittskarte in die Welt des Hoffens, weil immerhin, vielleicht ist mir dann Mittwoch oder ist man dann am Sonntag bei den Gewinnern? Meistens nicht.
Hast du schon mal was gewonnen?
Vernachlässigbar. Also natürlich, wir wissen, bei solchen Dingen gewinnt immer das Casino oder die Bank oder eben die Lotteriegesellschaft. Aber in diesem Fall, ich sag's nochmal, glaube ich, dass es nicht so ist. Und wir können jetzt auch gerne wetten um eine Flasche. Naja, Tokaja, ungarische mag ich nicht so gerne, aber da gibt es mittlerweile ganz gute Tröpfchen. Also schauen wir mal. Gut. Ich bin bereit für die Wette.
Das besprechen wir dann nachher. Jetzt nun zurück zu uns.
Wir werden ja dann sehen, wie es ausgeht. Ne?
Genau. Aber wie auch immer es ausgeht, für die Grünen und auch andere progressive Oppositionsparteien in dem Land ist die Wahl mit gemischten Gefühlen verbunden. Denn die politische Landschaft hat sich radikal verändert. TISA ist eine konservative Partei. Ihr Vorsitzender Peter Magyar kommt selbst aus dem Fidesz-Umfeld. Und fast alle kleineren Oppositionsparteien, ob jetzt die Grünen, die Sozialisten, Momentum und LMP, haben auf eine Kandidatur verzichtet, um die Stimmen der Opposition nicht zu spalten. Und wenn die Umfragen stimmen, werden im nächsten Parlament nur drei Parteien sitzen. TISA, Fidesz und die Rechtsextreme Unsere Heimat, die sich rechts von Fidesz positioniert und bei Umfragen zwischen 5% und 8% erhält.
Das heißt, drei rechte Parteien im Parlament und keine einzige progressive Kraft. Unsere Gesprächspartnerin Temea Szabo kennt dieses Dilemma aus erster Hand, denn sie ist seit 2010 Abgeordnete im ungarischen Parlament, zunächst für die Partei Politik kann anders sein, dann als Mitbegründerin und Co-Vorsitzende von Pabeszed, der Grünen Partei, zusammen mit dem Budapester Bürgermeister Gergely Karasoni. Szabo hat sich in den vergangenen Jahren als eine der lautesten Stimmen gegen Orbans Machtmissbrauch, gegen Korruption und gegen die Aushöhlung von Grundrechten einen Namen gemacht. Nachdem aber Pabeszed im Februar angekündigt hat, nicht bei den Parlamentswahlen anzutreten, kandidiert Szabo nun als unabhängig in ihrem Budapester Wahlkreis in Obuda, dem dritten Bezirk. Die Chancen auf ein Direktmandat sind allerdings schwierig. Laut einer aktuellen Umfrage eines führenden Forschungsinstituts liegt die TISA-Kandidatin Boda Nicoletta bei 48%, der Fidesz-Kandidat bei 25% und Szabo eben bei 17%. Die Sozialisten haben sie sogar öffentlich aufgefordert, zugunsten der TISA-Kandidatin zurückzutreten.
Temea Szabo erzählt über die Stimmung in Ungarn, über die Hoffnung auf einen Machtwechsel und die Sorge, dass selbst ein Ende der Ära Orban nicht automatisch ein Sieg für liberale und progressive Werte wäre. Und darüber, was Europa aus 16 Jahren Fidesz-Herrschaft lernen kann. Hören wir uns das an.
Maybe when we come. Start with giving your analysis of where we stand for the elections. The polling is pretty clear. The government polls give a so-so picture, and all the, let's say, more independent polls shows a clear lead for TISA. And so where do you see it? When you look at the crystal ball, what do you see?
I definitely see a need for change, and it's in the air that also people want to change this government. They're really sick and tired of all the corruption, all the inhuman measures they've been taking, all the persecution of various social groups such as LGBTQ people and the poor and the homeless and the old and now young people are also targets of the government. So people here in Hungary just want freedom and want to get rid of this corrupt Orbán regime.
But also the liberal opposition is in a little bit of a bind because, of course, Tisza is also a conservative party. I think Peter Magyar himself says it's like bringing back basically taking Orbán out of the urbanism and go back to what it was before with a high growth, also economically liberal climate, and a conservative values, family values, etc. So it looks like maybe after the election, even if we don't have Orbán anymore in this country, we still might have a conservative government, and you represent the liberal progressive left, let's say. Greens, also, you must be in a little bit of a, I don't know, maybe mixed feelings, let's call it.
that's one way to put it. That a lot of us have mixed feelings about this election, but it was very predictable that after demonizing the opposition for 16 years, making us look like that we're all puppets of Gyurcsány, the former Prime Minister Gyurcsány, it was almost inevitable that the potential new government will come from the right, will come from the conservative side. It's not easy to see what's happening with my country, because if the polls are correct, then it means that there will be three right-wing parties in the next parliament, a Nazi party, a half-Nazi party, Fidesz, and a conservative party, Tisza. So for us, progressive social democrats, liberals, greens, it's definitely not easy. But we have to prioritize at this point, what's more important, to change this government or to continue representing our values in a repressive regime, under Orbán. And I think the choice that a lot of people are making now is that first we have to get rid of Orbán and his corrupt regime, and then we can restore democracy.
And when you look at what happened, what do you think, or when was the tipping point that, at least again, the election is only won after, the polling has happened, but still it seems that there must have been some sort of crack in the, let's say, the Fidesz coalition of people from the industrialists, business people, people who are like a lot of doctors and people from the medical field are working for, are in Tisza now. So why do you think that his coalition, this really looks, at least what the posters, what I've read is, okay, basically rural population, older people, maybe they're more detached, let's say, media, just state, consuming state media, that seems to be what happened. Well, the question is, why did people desert him, finally?
I think it was a gradual thing. I don't think there was one specific crack or one specific event. I think people are tired of living in fear, tired of feeling all the hate that's coming from the government at this point, and tired of feeling that they're the bad guy all the time within the European Union, and also tired of becoming or are concerned about becoming the puppet of Russia. I mean, Hungarians since St. Stephen, our first king, have wanted to belong to Europe, not to Russia. I mean, we were under Russian occupation for 40 years. They know what it's like. They don't want that. And it's really a disaster and very disheartening to see how a once freedom fighter Orbán, who spoke out against the Russian troops stationing in Hungary in 89, are now is now pushing Hungary back to that Soviet style of a regime. So most people don't want to see that. And unfortunately, people in rural areas, they don't have access to independent media. They're more open to, they're more open and available to that Russian style propaganda that Orbán has been pushing. So I don't think they are able to make an informed decision at this point. It doesn't mean that they're stupid. It just, you know, that this is what they hear constantly from the state-owned radio, from state-owned television, for the government owns over 1,000 media organizations. So apart from those people who don't have access to independent media, people really see what's happening now and they just want to change.
Let's stay with the Soviet/Russian question for a while, because why we have the year 2026? So 1956 is an important year in Hungary's history. So I want to stay with that, because also that is surprising, at least from the vantage point of Vienna, where, of course, we had a lot of refugees coming at that year. A lot of Hungarians made a great careers. Many of them are very, even, you know, Paul Lendweil, an old man, is one doyen of journalism in Austria, Hungarian origin, still speaking with a nice Hungarian accent. And he, I think, is always spoke out very clearly about Orban in the last 3 years. And also I think he never understood why this Russian doesn't make sense to people like him. And that is interesting, isn't it? I mean, how can you change the narrative so much that people just forget that they cut out, you know, their flags, that they gave their lives on the street? They're still in Budapest, probably, if you look around, they're still, and remember, I saw bullet holes still in some of the houses that came from that time and not from World War II. So
this is the question that I cannot answer, to be honest, and many of us cannot answer. It's a big mystery. Yeah, Orban and Fidesz have built their entire campaign on the inheritance of 56, that they are the anti-communists, they are the freedom fighters. They're you know, they want liberal democracy and want equal rights, and yet, you know, this is happening. I don't think you can really explain this. Of course, there are a lot of guessing about how this can be happening, that Putin has a file on Orban or et cetera. We don't know. That's, you know, it's really, really shocking. And it's a betrayal, you know, of our whole belief system, so to say. So it's very surreal, because he's one of his ministers, or his political director, also called Orban, Balázs Orban, I think last year or 2 years ago, said that
he's in the Covino.
That Hungarians would have been smarter if they had given up on, you know, in 56. Practically, that was his message, because referring to the Ukrainians, that Ukrainians should just raise the white flag in front of the Russians and just give up their freedom fight. Because we also know what happened in 56. And so everybody was really mad at his statement. So what are you saying, that we shouldn't have fought against the Soviet invasion and Soviet occupation in 56? That was your ideology. So we really cannot explain what's happening. And clearly it's not in the interest of Hungary. The interest of Hungary is to remain in the European Union, to be part of that democratic family that respects basic human rights and believes in equality, and not the Putin style regime where journalists and the opposition politicians can be jailed and people fall out of the window if they go against Putin. That is not the kind of country that we want to live in.
But also, one has to give it to Orban that he is a very smart and able politician. I mean, given just from a neutral, let's just look at his skill set. And what's also interesting is that he punches way beyond his weight in terms of representing a small country that is, you know, also more on the periphery of the European Union than, let's say, Austria is, and a little bit bigger than Austria in terms of population. And of course, then he integrated himself into this, let's say, in conservative movement that we only now, I think, start to understand, with, you know, Peter Thiel, with these think tanks that they are here in Hungary, the Corvinus Collegium, connects them. I think CPAC is just, when is it? Next, in 10 days or something, here again in Budapest. So how do you see that? I mean, this is quite interesting that he managed to become also this figurehead of this, whatever it is it conservative, it has socialist elements, it's a very strange political animal. Is what you have created, this Frankenstein monster in a way. And Donald Trump is part of it. J.D. Vance is part of it. Links with the Catholics, with evangelicals, with religious groups, with the neo-radical liberals when it comes to kind of the Austrian School of Economics. And this stuff. So it's very interesting, isn't it? I mean, how do you... What is he doing? Is he like play jazz in a way and just see what's, or has he just had a master plan? I mean,
I don't think you can describe it with an ideology at this point. As you said, it's a Frankenstein. That's the best way to describe it. It's not based on any vision on what kind of country he wants to lead or create. It's simply based on power, how to keep power forever. So this is what he learned. His 2002 defeat against the socialists really hit him hard. And that's when he realized that he hadn't done his homework before. He hadn't seized the media. He hadn't used propaganda before. And he didn't organize the state in a way that he just cannot be ousted. So I think the next 8 years when the socialists were in power, he was doing his homework in that sense. So when he came to power again in 2010, he very consciously already started building a state that just cannot get rid of him. So I think that's the sole purpose now, that he and a very narrow circle of his friends and family get rich and cannot be removed. There's no any other ideology based on that. And this is what other like-minded people have learned. I don't think, to be honest, that Orbán is homophobic. I don't think he really cares about refugees. He just uses these people as scapegoats to run these hate campaigns and to persecute people, to always create fear against an outside enemy. He always creates a non-existing enemy and he offers his voters to protect them against that non-existing enemy. And that's the secret of his, so to say, power. And that's just a very despotic, attitude. So you don't, while when it comes to public services such as healthcare and education and social services, everything is going down in a drain. I mean, and the Hungarian healthcare system is horrible. Education is under the frog. I mean, what's really cynical is that they've ruined the education system, yet all of the ministers' children go to private schools, So we keep telling them, like, look, what you did this to the education system. Like, why don't you just have your children participate in this? Of course, you don't, because you know that it's really horrible now and it's ruined. So they know exactly what they're doing, and it has nothing to do with what they believe. They've learned from other countries, mainly in, like Asian countries, how to keep this power based on fear. And this is what other European countries are learning now. And we warned the EU 10 years ago about this. We warned the EU that as long as they keep funding Orbán and let them steal all the EU funding, he's going to stay in power.
Hungary without the European Union is nothing. Like, Britain just learns it the hard way, what it means for your economy if you crashing out from the European Union. So why do you think how does he differentiate between, let's say, Brussels and the European Union?
He very consciously using the word Brussels and not the EU, because he knows that Hungarians are very pro European Union. I think the highest support is almost among all European countries is in Hungary. So it's also something to, something that's hard to understand, but not as much as not so much if you know Orbán and his strategy. His goal is not to quit the EU, because Putin needs and the Chinese need someone within the EU, and Hungary is a good sort of gate country for them to enter and be in the EU. Putin's purpose, and this is what he uses Orban for, is to constantly weaken Europe and to dismantle the European Union. He wants to dismantle the entire system and the entire union, not to take Hungary out, because what's the purpose of that for Putin? This is why, you know, it's out in the open since then that the 10 years ago, the refugee crisis was boosted by Putin in Syria. So this is why it was, he artificially created this, you know, the crisis in Syria to, so that, you know, millions of refugees start flowing towards Europe and start weakening Europe. And it worked. It did weaken Europe as a whole. And if you look at the United States led by Trump now, if you look at the document that was leaked at the end of last year about their foreign strategy, that also said that the EU should be dismantled and Austria and Hungary and Slovenia should be taken out of the European Union. That also served the purpose of weakening the EU. So now, you know, the European Union used to be the target of Russia alone. Now it's the target of both the United States and Russia. So the EU has to wake up from this sort of dormant position and see what's happening. And I hope that it's not too late. But the first really effective measure that the EU took against Hungary is when they froze the funding, for sure.
You just mentioned that it's deeply ingrained into the states and the system, their structures, let's say. And of course, we see and observe in Poland how difficult it is also to dismantle these structures, to go back to where things were before. And, well, one can say that this might be even more difficult than Hungary, because Orban has been, in some respects, more clever than peace. And of course, the period of rule is much longer. Even he was in power, let's not forget, before when the Social Democrats came into power, they basically lost the election. So he has been a factor of Hungarian politics for a long, 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 long time. So what can we expect? Even let's assume that Tisza will win this election, the opposition can take over. It's not going to be, you know, walk in the park to kind of bring back, you know, some sort of normalcy to this country, right?
Yes, absolutely. I think it's, you know, it's one thing to win the election, but it's another thing how to get rid of them in a long run. And that's certainly a most difficult question. What Hungary can hope for is that the unfreezing of the EU funding, you know, that will be a big help, because the economy will be in a horrible state. At that point, the budget deficit is skyrocketing. So is the foreign deficit. It's all-time high. It's funny how Orban used to campaign against the IMF in a loan. Now the debt is a lot higher than ever before. So Hungary keeps getting all these foreign loans from China, of course, which is another scary thing apart from Russia. So, and I don't think any new party will have two-thirds majority. So all these laws that matter now that can dismantle this system are based on two-thirds majority law. So we have to figure out a way how to do this smart. Again, this is when, if, you know, considering how much the EU contributed to maintaining Orban in power for 10 years, now it will be their time to help the country, you know, get back on track. Because if it hadn't been to Angela Merkel, for example, who we know hated Orban, but as long as Orban catered for all German investments, such as BMW, Mercedes, Audi, she, you know, looked away. She didn't care what Orban did. And they kept financing Orban regime, even if they knew that he was stealing all the money. So the EU, unfortunately, has a huge responsibility for maintaining these thugs in power.
You mentioned the healthcare system is in a terrible shape, schools, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, now with the crisis in the Middle East, inflation is already back on the table, and the oil price will not come down so soon. So even there, he has to do something, right? The price controls, et cetera. So what do you think in terms of also bringing, building rebuilding this country. I mean, look where Poland is today. Look, even Romania overtook Hungary in terms of, GDP, per capita in PPP terms. And you see, actually, even I see when I go to Belgrade, and even Belgrade in some respects looks better in shape in some parts than Budapest. I mean, so how is that going to be? I mean, do you think that there might be some renaissance in a way that people say, well, and finally, let's get to work. We need now to rebuild the healthcare system, rebuild the education system, trying to just go back because you belong basically where Czechia is. You belong where Poland is. I mean, Hungary was, I was there as a kid coming here, buying a cheap film from Ofotert and so on. Yeah, I mean, this was the most advanced country of the Comecon, I mean, the most advanced, if needed, GDR when it comes to industry. But, and it was kind of squandered in these last 16 years, for sure.
Yeah, it's really disheartening to see that and to watch that, because I remember before we joined the EU, along with other Central European countries, we were definitely the front runners among those countries. We were far the best in terms of economy and welfare system and everything. And as you say, yeah, now even Romania is ahead of us. So it's a real shame that people, you know, can see that here. But again, they're so brainwashed at this point that they don't even believe that that's true. They say, oh, it's Soros and Zelensky and von der Leyen making this up that Romania is doing better.
And are you hopeful that there might be, let's say, some push for, let's say, a national renaissance or a national renewal in terms of when there is a political change that people say, well, let's now kind of rebuild the welfare state, rebuild certain, you know, political structure. I mean, the Supreme Court is in the hands of Fidesz. I mean, there's so
everything is in the hands of Fidesz. Yeah.
So basically, you have to start from scratch some way. I mean, is the country ready for that?
I think so. In a way, it would be like after World War II when everything was, well, physically in ruins and people just said, okay, we have to start over. Now, everything is ruined, not physically, but in any, every other way. And I think people will first take a deep breath, smell the fresh air, and then they say, okay, let's start over. I think the most important thing on the first day after the election is to stop this hate, spurring this hate against each other. We are one nation. We have to unite. We cannot live all the time in this fear, and we cannot look at each other as enemies. This is the era that Orban has created. I think people will understand that, and I think they will be relieved. Even some Fidesz voters will be relieved that it's over. You don't want your kids to look at those billboards that we have up. That is just, you know, really horrible. All about hate. And who's to blame, who's to hate, who's to be afraid of. We have to unite again. And as you say, there will be a renaissance, I believe. We don't have any other choice. If Tiso wins and we continue this kind of, you know, policy, then the Hungary won't change.
Now, maybe my last question is, when I talk with people very often, there's a certain regret that we, in this case, I mean, Europe, didn't learn the lesson or didn't look closely, because what you have here is maybe more clear than basically. I see the same thing with Kickl and the FPÖ. You see the same with the AfD. It's the same playbook. It's gender. In German, Kickl speaks of the Genderwahn. Here is the same thing. We have migration, this little less, and we have questions of peace, basically, where you blame the victim and not the perpetrator. And it's the same. I mean, it's in Austria, the FPÖ, it's the same playbook. Even when I look at the kind of what we see, it's the same playbook. And we didn't maybe see that, okay, a lot of things were pioneered here, at least in the last couple of years. For some time, I think it was Austria pioneering things. Maybe Berlusconi, I'm sure, was pioneering things, but we could have learned a lot. And Europe could have learned a lot. And what do you think that, what did we miss? And what is the lesson that you think, okay, well, you have to look at it. And at the same time, there's also a lot to learn for Hungary, I think, when we look at maybe what still might be coming with election interference and what we saw in Romania, maybe what, again, to learn afterwards in Poland. So again, if you look at lessons, both for Hungary and both for the rest of Europe, what is it, you think? What did we miss? What should we learn? What can we learn?
What did you miss? Well, you missed everything. You missed everything. And it makes me really angry because 15 years ago, I was already in parliament. And when Orbán passed a new media law, we went to Brussels. We spoke out in the European Parliament and we warned Europe that this is a cancer that will spread. And nobody believed us and nobody really thought that this would be possible. They used to think that Hungary will be an isolated case because all other countries are saying and it's just not going to happen. 15 years ago, you could have prevented this. The Greens in the European Parliament spoke out they were very vocal. And again, even today, Daniel Freund, you know, from Germany, from the Greens, he almost single-handedly arranged that the funding should be free, frozen. And so the Greens listened. Nobody else did. We told them that the same thing is going to happen with the media law, the constitutional court, all the checks and balances. And when we spoke with your government officials, I mean, yours and other, you know, like all over Europe, they said, oh, yes, we know, but our government has to focus on domestic issues. And we warned them that, look, you don't understand. This will be your domestic issue soon. It's not a Hungarian issue. It's a European issue. And no one cared until it started really spreading with Meloni in Italy, with Wilders in the Netherlands. Okay, now he's out, but the same phenomenon. Well, now it's in Sweden. Who would have thought, 10 years ago that, Sweden, that's the front runner in human rights and social justice, will be in the hands of the right wing, the far right. Now, unfortunately, Europe has to bear the consequences of being so ignorant and focusing on their very own selfish issues. And now the cancer has spread. So we have to look for new immune therapy for that type of cancer. And we really have to work together.
Das war unser Gespräch mit Temer Szabo. Was dabei klar herauskommt, ist erstens, der Wunsch nach Veränderung in Ungarn ist überwältigend. Die Menschen scheinen nach 16 Jahren Fidesz-Herrschaft erschöpft. Und zweitens, selbst wenn Orbán abgewählt wird, steht das Land vor enormen Herausforderungen. Das Gesundheitssystem, das Bildungswesen, die Justiz, die Medienlandschaft, all das muss praktisch von Grund auf neu aufgebaut werden. Und für progressive Kräfte stellt sich die bittere Frage, war der Preis für den Regierungswechsel, dass die liberale und grüne Stimme im Parlament verstummt?
Ja, und Martina, auch die Frage an dich. Was kann eigentlich Ungarn von Polen da lernen? Die haben ja auch diesen Umbau versuchen müssen.
Ja, aber sie sind noch immer dabei, diesen Umbau rückgängig zu machen. Also die Lektion ist, dass es je länger es dauert, je länger eine Partei oder eine Gruppierung die Chance darauf hat, Institutionen umzubauen, umso effektiver wird das und umso schwieriger wird das wieder zurückzubilden. Also in beiden Ländern wird noch viel Zeit dafür notwendig sein, das wieder zu stärken, was geschwächt wurde.
Ja, und neben dieser Lehre aus Polen für Ungarn gibt es auch eine Mahnung aus Ungarn an Europa. Und zwar, die EU hat zu lange zugeschaut, sagt Szabo, wie in Ungarn die Demokratie ausgehebelt wurde. Und dieser Prozess war ein Warnsignal und Europa hat das ignoriert. Jetzt sehen wir auch ähnliche Muster in anderen Ländern. Den Link zum Gespräch mit Temer Szabo finden Sie in den Shownotes.
Ebenso Informationen zur soeben erschienenen Ausgabe der European Voices.
Das war Kapitel 13 unserer East Side Stories. Jeden letzten Donnerstag im Monat erscheint eine neue Podcast-Folge.
Schön, dass Sie dabei waren.
Hören Sie uns wieder.
Das war's, ja.
Servus.